Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Okay, so you are the author of a book called Systems Thinking.
Learning Systems Thinking.
Learning Systems Thinking. Yeah. Even better, because we're here to learn. Yeah. You're also talking about architecture, right, at this conference. And I was thinking this morning, I know what a system is. I've worked with systems my whole life. I thought I knew what an architect was, but occasionally I look at job postings for an architect and I realize I have no idea what an architect actually is supposed to be. So I'm going to get you to start with your definition of what an architect actually is.
Oh, hooray. Let's start with the most divisive subject in tech and have me go on record.
Yeah.
What's wonderful, though, is because I'm an architect, I get to say, because it's true, it depends. It depends. And the thing, we're fighting about what an architect is. To some extent, it's because I think we're still trying to figure this out. Like, what is it? And also, different situations will need different types of interventions and types of skills. And so what might be architecture in one circumstance might be totally inappropriate in another. So this sounds like I'm hedging, but I'm not, because it's not a binary. There is not one architect to rule them all, and there doesn't need to be. So I have a talk that the first slide is, let's stop fighting about what an architect is.
Okay.
And then we get on Twitter, architect is a bullshit role, and now we have to defend the existence. So in my world, I say that I became a systems architect in order to survive, but that was really true in that we were designing and delivering monolithic software inside the container of one piece of software. And increasingly, that software was in relationship to other software and other software and other software and other software. Now it's ubiquitous. We have it in our pocket. So Donella Meadows says that we think that because we understand one, we understand two, because one and one make two, but we actually have to understand and. And so I would define architecture as the art and science of and. How do relationships produce effect? What are the patterns in a particular system that are reinforcing the problems we think are just randomly happening, but they aren't? So, and that's what I would say an architect is.
Okay. You're instantly making me think of a time in my career when this was attempted and it failed. So maybe I can tell you about that. So I worked at a bank, which I will not name, and they were basically, they pretended they were one company. They were islands of small companies that didn't work together. And their solution of the day to get people to work together was weekly meetings between all the different teams, where someone from each team was sat in a room, and that was going to magically fix it. And the reality was, everybody in each different team was already massively overloaded and didn't really have time for this meeting. From that system, how do you even begin to build any kind of and
so
when you're already
right,
under the water?
And that, the biggest risk, I think, for people with these types of skills is we end up playing glue roles. Right? Mm. That's like magically you can stick together things that don't want to stay together and then continue to reinforce them, right? We call it cat herding.
Yeah.
And over time, how about nobody gets to be a cat. Let's do that instead.
Right.
Like, instead of bringing in people or setting up that meeting that forces people to interact, we redesign how we think and communicate together. Why are these silos? Why do they exist? Is it something we get that's beneficial from the silo? Or is this just the way we do things? Are we hiring people on Team A and Team B that know how to communicate, that know how to design and together? For me, ideally, the more obsolete I make myself, the more I think that I'm successful, right? That it's facilitating the types of changes that the whole system operates better. If you always need me to force people to coordinate and communicate, then I'm not really changing the system. I'm just using my own energy. And also, often, if all three teams are incentivized for different things and no one is incentivized for collective reasoning, for their ability to self-organize together, then you're asking them to do work that doesn't even personally benefit them. So there's also the shift in mindset about how to create these relationships, how to manage the information flow and the exchange that happens that isn't just a meeting.
You're making me think that your role as an architect is less building the system the company thinks it's building, and dealing with the system the company actually is.
Yes, but not because I have all the answers and they don't have the answers. But one of the things that we know, there's been a lot of system science, right? So we have people like Jay Forrester and Danella Meadows and Peter Senjay and Russell Acuff. So we have a lot of wisdom to draw on. And there are two things that we know about people thinking together as complexity increases. The first thing is we blame. This is what we do. We blame. Which would be fine, except we blame the wrong thing. And what we usually blame is the other team, right? Or leadership or something. Now, again, if we were correct, that'd be great. But we usually aren't correct. Our first instinct of what's going wrong is not usually what is going wrong. It's pushing away our discomfort. And then the second, and probably the most impactful, is counterintuitiveness, meaning that we do understand where the pain point was. Like in your story, the pain point was the silos, probably, right? That actually was causing pain.
Yeah.
But because of counterintuitiveness, organizations are almost always pushing it in the wrong direction. They're making it worse. And this is not just what we know from tech. This is what we know from most human systems. Mm. So because of counterintuitiveness, organizations are often blaming the wrong thing and doing the wrong thing. And it's not like one person can come in and magically go, I know the answer. Because as Danella Meadows says, we also know from bitter experience that because of counterintuitiveness, when you do find a leverage point, you do say this would help, no one will believe you. And so it is not so much that I'm trying to architect the system that the organization needs, not what the organization wants. It's that there is no what the organization wants. If you talk to every C-level, they're going to describe a different outcome. Like, there often isn't even a synthesized understanding of what it is the organization wants. And also, what we want is not necessarily matched with what is possible. So it is a bit of a speaking truth to power, I think, role. Mm. Not always, but it is, it, I, I encourage everyone else to go through our own consent process. Like, I understand the thinking and around me. I understand what you're asking me for. What convinced you that this is what we need to do? What are the goals? Like, to ask these types of questions that can help illuminate more impactful questions, right? Architecture is more about the frame of the question than the answer in those circumstances. And so a different question might help them look at the problem slightly differently. So it is, not just doing what you're told.
So I'm trying to get to where your headspace is at with this, right? And I'm instantly thinking we have this model of the way companies are supposed to work, which is the CEO has a clear vision, communicates the clear vision to the rest of the company. The architect decides what the software is that will implement that clear vision, tells the software developers, they build it, everyone's happy until the next quarter, right? There are enough people laughing in the audience that they at least recognize that. Your world, the world you're trying to get to seems completely different to that.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes. It's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Different and the same. First of all, does that actually happen? Because that would not be within my, I mean, that's the idea.
That's the model, right?
Right? That's the idea. So when I teach workshops, I have a fictitious company that I use in my workshops. And people will see the models and go, oh, like every system I've seen in the last 15 years. Yes, that's it. So the thing is that the CEO's primary strategy in most organizations is investment from the board, right? Is about the how to generate growth and revenue. And the CEO is partnered with other people, the CMO, the CFO, who is part of contributing to what needs to happen in order to have that outcome. And just because we know we want to increase revenue by 10% with this particular product doesn't mean that we actually know how. Not only that, but the reality of systems is that you might do something that you think will make things better, and then everything is worse. Or you do something and you discover it makes things better and that wasn't even really your intention. So the thing is that there is no linear path to this is the goal and we make a Gantt chart and if we do these behaviors and then in this amount of time, this is exactly what will happen, right? Yeah. That would be great, but that's not what happens, right?
That's not what happens, right?
Because there are a whole lot of other forces involved in this process. So this is called reductionism, meaning that we can be in a situation that has multiple forces acting on it, and we can just split up the parts into smaller parts, and if you understand each part and tweak them, you understand what the system will do. Mm. But it doesn't work that way. By understanding the individual parts, you don't understand how the relationships between those parts produce effect, or how the outside world might change and put new forces on them. And so I would say that what we're really doing is figuring out how to synthesize what the CEO knows and needs with what software tools actually exist, with what the users are experiencing, with what the trends and patterns in the industry are. So it isn't so much you're wrong, you're right, you're this, as it is, what does it look like if I bring these different points of view together and describe the system? does it help us to know what the most impactful thing to do would be, right? So if I know that the CEO has a, this is what we're trying to do, and we're designing a system that has that purpose, there's a whole lot of work to be done in order to understand how this current socio-technical system can accomplish that goal. Like, that there's infinite amount of work that could be done.
Yeah. Infinite amounts of work scare me. And another thing that scares me is infinite scope, right? Because what you're describing seems to me like I need to get the entire holistic picture in order to move forward. But I don't think anyone's possibly capable of that.
No. And that's the... So in what you're describing, when what you're describing describes discomfort with uncertainty, right? We don't want to be uncertain. We want to be certain, and we want to act on certainty. But in, we know from lots of experience, if you've been in tech for like 5 minutes, you already know that the certainty is somewhat delusional, right? Like, we can't be certain. But what we can do is come up with the best possible action under the circumstances and then learn from that. So my argument is that noise is the scope problem, meaning that everyone has ideas and everyone's doing the, and we're all having these, and then we'll do this and we'll go here and we'll do, and all of these things are happening at the same time, but we actually really don't know what we might do in this circumstance that will unlock, that will enable the change that we're trying to make. And when we say that we don't have time for architecture, it's amusing to me in the sense that you're architecting with every decision you're making, with every choice you're making, you're architecting. So you can either deliberately engage in that process and iteratively engage in that process, or you can do it later. But whether you think you have time or not, you'll need that time. And so the challenge is, what are the practices that we do that help us to be able to make better choices with our actions and our theories and our recommendations? Like, what are the skills that we need as technologists and just as humans that help us to synthesize information and come up with this, even though we can't possibly know if we're right?
Yeah.
Right? We're trying to be correct, but what is right in what is right even, right?
So we're inevitably going for our best guess at the system.
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, systemic reasoning is about we've used it as a method of inquiry. We've done some due diligence, and other people can engage with our recommendation and understand how we came to this conclusion, and they can help us to strengthen it. Like, there's another point of view that makes this recommendation less strong. And so the leveraging the power of knowledge work, the fact that we all have this experience and knowledge, but instead of the battle of opinions and cat herding and power and control and politics, instead we're trying to just actually see what's going to make a difference here. And if we don't get it right, learn from that and do it again. You don't get that in a strictly top-down communication thinking structure. Everyone I'm sure in this room knows that the CEO doesn't know jack shit about the software unless the communication pattern goes back up again.
Yeah.
Right? So you're working up and down the macro-micro scale, but you don't need to know everything because the people around you know. Like, they know, you're partnering with them. Like, I don't have to figure out exactly how we're going to implement Kafka because I work with brilliant people who are in there today figuring it out. I just need to be able to connect what they know with what the CEO knows and figure out, will those things together get us where we're going?
So my anxiety about having to communicate with other people to understand the whole system actually goes away, and I can just communicate with them to understand enough to offload.
Yes, and that this is why, you know, people say, so I was being interviewed and I loved this. He said, Diana, I already have so much conceptual load and it gets worse every day. And now you're saying I have to think about everything. Like, right. A little bit in that I made a list of the types of skills that I would have anticipated that people who were applying for engineering teams that I was leading would have, and then what the skills that I would that they would need now. And it was hysterical in a crying kind of way, like how much that has changed. And so the it is a particular skill set, and not everyone has to sign up for that skill set, right? Like, I think that for a lot of people, this type of work is just not what they want to do, or not even what they want to learn to do. Mm. But at the same time, if you don't have it at all, then the current system will continue to repeat. So, Piersig in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance says, right, the real system is the construction of rationality itself. It's an organization that works like you describe, we made that up. That's our paradigm. We made that up. That's not like truth. It's just how we work. Yeah. And he said that if a factory is torn down, but the rationality that created it remains, then that rationality will just build another factory. And this was my experience moving from monolith to microservices. Like, our microservices were very tightly coupled because our brains were very tightly coupled. Yeah. This is what we knew we had to learn. And so the Kent and I were just joking, and Michael and I did this the other day. It's my favorite thing. There's a wonderful snarky website, SADMF, sad MF, right? And I love this because it promises enterprise transformation without the risk of culture change. And as an architect, I have been brought into big organizations that want to modernize, you know, hey, Diana, come and architect this digital transformation thing. Well, no, we're not going to, like, change anything about how we do things. You're going to make us a North Star model. What is the target system so the engineers know what to do?
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, I'd love to live in a world in which I could just tell a group of people what to do and they say, yes, ma'am, and they do it. But I do not live in that world, like, at all. Also, I don't know. This is a big system that's grown over decades. We're going to need an architecture practice to be able to discern what is the most impactful change. Also, we're not going to migrate from here to there in one big thing. This is iterative. We're going to do things. I call it the greenhouse, right? We're going to do some experiments. We'll have that in production, design the relationships, and iteratively go there. Because usually in legacy systems, there are some aspects of legacy that are still totally valid, right? We don't have to change everything. The chief product officer said, to me once, it's like, I'm so glad you're here because now we'll have microservices. But why do you want microservices? And this is the answer to your question about just doing what people say, right? So the product officer said, I'm excited to have microservices. Okay, what do you mean? And through the conversation, I realized that the primary challenge is they can't build products because the software, everything is so tightly coupled. There's no front end. There's just software. And so he had heard along the way that microservices fixed the problem. But if I just went and built him microservices, I wouldn't have fixed his problem because I didn't understand his problem. And in the workshop, in the masterclass this week, this came up a lot, that we're always translating. People can't tell you what the problem is because they don't know, right? Like the product people will use words and the technologists will use words, but none of us are looking at the whole, right? And so one of the things that I'm constantly learning to do is listen to what people are saying and understanding what those patterns are in what they're saying. So what is the thing I can change that gives them what they want? Maybe it's microservices, but microservices is how, not what.
Yeah, yeah. It's the classic thing of focusing on the implementation detail too quickly.
Right.
You're making me think, obviously, a lot about communication. This is very much related, and it's related to the programmer mindset that I want to ask you. Like, as a programmer, one of my highest values is consistency in a system, right? You're already smiling at me, right? And if I expand that out to human systems, socio-technical systems, as you call them, like, to what degree do we need consensus to have healthy communication? Do we need to have a consistent worldview as a company to be healthy?
Those are two very, very big questions. I love that. I do. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about the first one first, consistency.
Yeah.
What is consistency in a distributed system, right? Like, I once had an engineer say, no, Diana, we're not talking about this events thing, MySQL forever. We need a source of truth. True, and in fact, we already have eventual consistency in an old piece of LampStack software. If you have varnish on top of it, you have eventual consistency, right? Like that, we're already doing it. So we want to have consistency, but consistency is a quality in a system that is not always its highest priority. There's often tolerance for eventual consistency. And so the challenge isn't so much designing a system that enables more asynchronous communication, more ability to respond to events, for parts of the system to respond to events in their own time. The problem is we go, consistency, right? And source of truth.
Yeah.
And so that one of the challenges is softening our our idea that consistency is security and highest value. For me, like a day where we're having a bug in production, if the bug is in the code, that's a good day, because it's usually not. It's somewhere between the parts, right? It's somewhere, or it's in the relationship between the parts, right? And that's what I'm concerned with. And so it's really exciting if a line of JavaScript had some false logic, because we can fix that. Consistency is harder. And so I think we're really rethinking what consistency means. And we need to. That's important. Because we won't build systems that have more flexibility if we're too focused on that.
We will limit our size
as
well, right?
Yeah. But again, it's about control. You can if you have to have absolute control, then you have to have a system small enough to control. And most of us don't anymore.
Yeah.
So Danella Meadows says that you can't control systems, but you can design and redesign them. And that's the goal here. Less about trying to control them and more about improving the relationships in the system so that even with eventual consistency, the system is operating better than it would have if you locked it down.
Right. Yeah.
So that was the first one. The second one was
consensus, which I feel is very related.
Yeah. No. Right. So I think I thought this, but I've worked in and with organizations that are very hierarchical, you know, do what I say. And I've worked with, because I come out of open source, right? So I've worked with what I call very hippie organizations that, you know, freedom. That was way worse. That's like, because every cat is a silo. right? And you have engineers, I think Michael and I were talking about this, you have engineers that are just like, I've waited out three CTOs and I'll wait you out too. Like, eventually you will go away and leave me alone and yeah. I'll just do what I want to do. So when you're doing systemic reasoning, it's totally fine that people disagree, because of course they do. That we have, what I say is, because my God, how many times have I experienced this? So one part of the organization wants a car. One product team wants a car. One team wants a boat. So the engineers are told to build a car boat. And everyone hates it because no one wanted a car boat,
yeah.
right? And so our ability to discern what to design, whether a car, a boat, or some properties that are some properties of both, is a very core architecture practice. And keeping from building a car boat that nobody wants. And so into the system of thinking, the concepts that we're putting, Fred Brooks says that conceptual integrity is the most important consideration in systems design. And he says the antithesis is many good but uncoordinated, non-interacting ideas. And I'm like, you mean like every system of software I work on? Every team and organization I work on?
Yeah.
So conceptual integrity is about how do we make the decision, the car boat decision, based on a shared understanding of what the system's purpose is and what will actually move the system forward, meaning it improves relationships in the system, it improves our ability, the system's ability to respond when it needs to respond, and who was it? Chris. Someone who does a lot of consulting, Chris Richards, on microservices. He and I were talking, and it came up, how many organizations have you gone into and said, okay, yes, we're going to look at your system. Where do I go to see and understand your system? And neither of us have ever seen that. Ever. That's my next book, actually, is how we do knowledge flow.
Yep.
So we have no shared understanding even of what the relationships in a system does. What are the capabilities that make up this system? For example, the New York Times, they have to write an article, improve an article, display an article in multiple contexts, right? There's all the things. So we don't really think in terms of systemic capabilities. What does this system do? What does it do? And what does it need to do? Mm. And what are the most valuable activities people are doing when they're using the system? So often if you're able to show people how a change actually opens up the possibility to do things like the CPO, right, who was saying we need microservices, but what he really means is I'd like to build some products. Like, and then that's what they want. So it's about reorienting the criteria for decision-making towards improving the system's ability to do what it does. And that's, we always did feature-driven engineering. Here's a feature, here are the requirements, go build it. Mm. And pretty quickly, we're like, yeah, except that these features are interrelated with the other features. And they don't, we just end up with a bunch of stuff that we kind of wanted or we didn't want or is really good. Now that we are decoupling so much, it's even more important because time has shifted. Now, we used to think in terms of linear time as well. Right, we thought Gantt chart, linear time, yeah. And then we had asynchronicity in our software systems because we had cron tasks. That was asynchronous, things that would run on the side.
Yeah.
But now one event can communicate to multiple pieces of software, and each of those pieces of software have their own concept of time. I don't have to do it right now. I would do it later. And this shifting our mind towards asynchronous relationships and systems. This is really, really challenging when we're used to linear. So my point being, we cannot try. No, I mean, I live in the U.S., right? There is no universe in which everybody is ever going to agree on everything, and we don't need that either. But we do, one of the things that systems architecture can give us is the criteria for choosing, when we don't know what to do, what matters the most, which is different from what generates the most revenue, because they're not directly correlated.
Go into that for me, because like I get the shape of what you're saying, but I feel like I need some practical instructions on how to get there.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think about how to give it without being too call out explicit. So I'll say this in a more general way, but it's also very specific. So the digital information systems came out of decades of page was your data object, right? You had a page. We had pages in books, pages in a newspaper. We laid out pages. And then HTML was invented to mark up academic papers. So this is a paragraph, this is a title, so that we could share them. This is what the internet was invented really to do. So we started building content management software to build digital pages, web pages, we think in pages. Now we have software designed for delivering pages in a world in which the information behind that is ubiquitous. You can ask Alexa in the kitchen for things from Wikipedia, and it's not thinking I'm getting it from a Wikipedia page, right? It's part of information. Or, for example, if you have a restaurant has a website, what we know is that people on their desktop are usually looking for a menu, and people on their phone are usually looking for the address. So can we give different information in different contexts? When you have an API and multiple consumers of the API, one presumes that not all consumers are interested in exactly the same amount of the exact same information, right? So everything is increasingly context dependent. So if I go into the situation and it's a giant pile of HTML in the database with inline styles because that's what they saved, and tell me what we need is to decouple the front end and everything will be fine. Like, okay, but now how is the back end going to give information to the front end? What do we do about the fact that the back end has CSS in it, which is the problem of the front end? So if we're going to separate concerns, we're going to have to structure the data. We're going to have to structure the data. We're going to have to create the relationship between these two different parts. No. React. We need React or Angular or Vue. We're going to fight about that for a year, and then we'll pick one.
So is this a metaphor then for, or is it potentially a metaphor for how you reorganize systems? Are you telling me this when I see a company that's not working and not delivering well, that I should look at how the information is structured within the organization?
That would be amazing, like if people started there. But the call is coming from inside the house. Most of the time, what's causing pain in an organization is actually happening because of what the organization believes is valuable, the way they've structured things, and the patterns that they do. And so if you're not going to change any of that, you're not going to change the outcome. And so it is how knowledge flows in an organization. This is a great place to wrap up. So Larry Prusak, he's a professor of knowledge management, and he died last year. I'd learned a lot from him. And he says that the production of knowledge is what makes organizations. And without understanding the flow of knowledge in the organization, they will die, and they won't even know what killed them. So his point of view is what you said is always at least one very important thing to understand. How does knowledge flow? But I design digital information systems. My point is knowledge flow. Like, how that's what we do. So yeah, the people and the tech are the same.
So is your job, very quickly, is your job to understand how knowledge flows, or to get everyone in the organization caring about how knowledge flows?
There's no way that I'm going to get everybody caring about anything I think they should care about. That's not going to happen. It would be to demonstrate to them that improved knowledge flow gives them more of what they want. That, okay, right? Because me just saying care, like they, you can't change doubt with more talking. Trust me, I try it all the time and it never works. People don't know, so I give them more words. It's through experience. Okay. So you're trying to create experiences that help people understand that shifting away from their traditional ways of working gives them more of what they really need.
That's a nice thing I can go away with and mull on, because I feel like we could explore this for another 3 hours easily. But we've got time for just a few questions, I think, so maybe we'll pass it over to the audience.
Thanks a lot. I want to go back to your question about the role of an architect. And we have business architects, system architects, we have enterprise architects, software architects. Do you see the arise of a new type of architect, also thinking both on AI and the more broad scope of what architects are going to do in the future?
Well, what I hope is that we stop siloing the idea of architect and sticking them into any place where there's pain and say, fix the pain. Because one human being can't do that. I do think, though, and this is maybe a little hopeful and naive from my part, but I've always been the same, saying a lot of the same things. No one, this isn't tech, Diana, where's the Kubernetes, right? And now it's a popular, people say, why is systems thinking so popular? Because I think we're very trendy, so this is our current trend. But also, global pandemic, things going on in the world, the increasing complexity in software, I think we're really understanding that everything is a systems problem. And so what I think will happen is not that we won't have a need for architects focusing on different points of view, because they need to, right? Business person thinks about the business, partners with me thinking about the tech. What I hope will happen is that we'll think of architecture as the practice that these people do together, right? The way that, so in systems, it's emergence, meaning one person can do something, another person can do something, but if you put them together, they can do something neither of them can do alone. And that is what I hope we come to understand from architecture practice, is that when you put them, when you encourage them to be friendly, you get better outcomes. Yeah.
At that point, we have to leave it. Diana Montelegon,
thank
you very much.
Thank you, Usman. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.